Peter B. Collins. News and comment for Thursday, August 21st, 2014. We now know there was a failed rescue attempt and ransom negotiations for Jim Foley.
Well, I pay the rent. You pay the ransom if you can.
I'll pay the rent, you pay the ransom if you can. I found this song online. It's Madison Violet. It's called The Ransom. And the backstory has surfaced now about the attempts by the Obama administration to spring Jim Foley before the Islamic militants who held him in Syria killed him. And they killed him first. It turns out there were negotiations over ransom, and it's a little bit fuzzy. It appears that the parents may have initiated that. But when the ransom demand was 100 million euros, about $132 million, the U.S. government said no. And then ISIS shifted. They had also demanded release of some prisoners, including one held in the United States. And when those demands were rebuffed, they shifted their rationale and said that they beheaded Jim Foley, the video journalist, because of the recent aerial strikes on IS positions in northern Iraq by American military jets. And as we look at this, there are a lot of issues that surface. First of all, paying ransom is a dicey prospect to begin with. Once you start to pay ransom to terrorists or kidnappers, whoever they happen to be, it's hard to stop. And the U.S. knows that European nations who have paid ransoms to these Sunni militants have provided at least $125 million over the last couple of years. And it's got to be a tough choice for a president to make. But the waters are muddied in many respects. For example, we dragged millions of dollars of cash bounty payments through the Islamic world over the last 10 years. We had the $25 million on the head of Osama bin Laden. There were $5 and $10 million bounties that were offered. And many of the men who wound up at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, were sold into our custody for modest bounty payments of about $5,000. And so the perception by our enemies is probably that, well, you can get the U.S. to pay ransom. They pay bounties. They offer cash for the heads of terrorists they're looking for. And, of course, in the U.S. media, this is never discussed. And the words that came from President Obama and Vice President Biden yesterday, while in the narrow context of the beheading of Jim Foley, the comments are appropriate, I described to one person that it left a kind of barfy taste in the back of my mouth. Why? Because when an American is killed in this brutal manner, we decry, deplore, denounce. But we brutally kill people, including innocents, on a regular basis. In my morning newspaper today, there is a picture of the 7-month-old baby, the son of a Hamas leader, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike on Gaza a couple of days ago. And how innocent is that life? 7 months old. Yet it doesn't have the value carried by a man who knowingly took risks and inserted himself in a war zone, Jim Foley. And I don't want to get into moral equivalence arguments and that sort of thing. I only want to point out that when we use brutality, we rationalize it. We say it's okay. One of the demands of IS has been the release of Afia Siddiqui. And her case has never gotten appropriate attention here in the United States. She was railroaded into prison on really murky charges of links to terrorists. She's a Pakistani neuroscientist who was trained at MIT. I don't believe she belongs in our prisons. But clearly, the members of the Islamic State know about Afia Siddiqui and believe that she is a victim of America's double standards. And now we are confronted with the threat from IS to perhaps behead, but at least kill, Stephen Sotloff, a freelance journalist who publishes in Time magazine, who has been held, we think, in the same location Jim Foley was. Now, we were unable to locate them when American commandos were inserted into Syria. A very risky move. It happened on July 4th of this year. And we're told that when our commandos went to a location where they thought they would find Foley and Sotloff, they had been moved. And so, my point here is not to take sides, not to demonize either Jim Foley or the president, who was appropriately outraged at this barbaric treatment, this barbaric act, but to look at the bigger picture and to understand that while our media gives this rosy picture of American intentions and America's purpose and creates the perception that we're victims and therefore we are permitted to use any means available to smite our foes. This is what creates blowback. And we will be paying for this for some time to come. Now surfaces John Allen, the retired Marine general who ran the war in Afghanistan from 2011 to 2013. He pipes up and calls on President Obama to order the destruction of the militant group IS. In an op-ed for the Defense One website, Allen echoes remarks by Secretary of State Kerry. It comes amid the internal dispute in the Obama administration over the future course of our latest war in Iraq, which is now about 2 weeks old. And it is this kind of call coming from one of our top generals that I find very troubling. And I want to thank Eileen Weber, a longtime listener and a subscriber to this podcast, who sent over an interesting commentary by Brian Fishman. And Fishman is a fellow at the New America Foundation. And he published this, I'll link to it, on a website called waronthrocks.com. And Fishman makes some very important points. And before I summarize Fishman's arguments here, I want to share a comment that was posted by another subscriber and longtime listener, Joe Clarici, on Facebook last night. And he said the brutal beheading of Jim Foley, quote, tests the limits of my non-interventionist convictions. And his next line was, F those people. And Joe, your reaction is quite understandable. And the feelings you expressed, I can appreciate. But in trying to F those people, we have to make sure that we don't F ourselves again. And if we can get beyond the code words here, we really fucked ourselves in our response to 9/11. As you know, I don't believe the official narrative of 9/11, but let's put that aside for now. The reaction by the leadership, the Congress, was to go to the dark side. And we have really screwed ourselves by embracing barbaric tactics that we thought might teach people a lesson. But the lesson they picked up is that the U.S. is capable of the lowest forms of human behavior. We do it with high-tech, high-powered weapons. We do it from the sky. We use drones. We monitor everybody's conversations all over the world. And every time we do this stuff, we screw ourselves. Because we are cementing the impression of imperialist America imposing its Christian vision on the Islamic world. Now to Brian Fishman's commentary. He says that the beheading of Jim Foley by the IS is a stark reminder of the group's terrible brutality and the seriousness required to counter them. He says that the real problem is the lack of a political debate in our country. He says that's the greatest threat to our global standing. He says that one can't argue that the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq in 2010 contributed to the rise of IS without also acknowledging that the invasion in 2003 did the same. And he also pushes back on the argument that if we had just funded the Free Syrian Army and supported them earlier, that ISIL wouldn't have arisen in the opposition to Assad in Syria. And that's wishful thinking in the rearview mirror. And he quotes retired U.S. Army Colonel Pete Mansour, saying that his assessment of the mission against IS is that we have to put 10,000 to 15,000 troops back into Iraq. And then Fishman says that it's fair to criticize Obama's policy as too limited or vague, but his policy is not to roll ISIL back. It's not to wipe out IS. That distinction makes a difference because, as others have pointed out, air power is much more effective against an army massing for an offensive than it is on troops settling in to govern in a populated area. He goes on to say that if destroying IS becomes the policy goal, then 10,000 to 15,000 troops vastly understates the true commitment, which will actually require years, direct military action on both sides of the Iraq-Syria border, tens if not hundreds of billions of dollars, and many more than 15,000 troops. He says maybe more like 150,000, which was, I believe, our peak in Iraq. And then Brian Fishman gets real. He says one thing's clear about Obama. Right or wrong in his decisions, he doesn't want to be fed a bunch of bullshit. And many of the arguments made about IS, Syria, and Iraq these days are spurious. The arguments to roll back IS fall into this category. Obama recognizes his critics are intentionally or unintentionally trying to back him into mission creep and perhaps create a new Benghazi scandal that they can blame on Obama and his team. And Fishman goes on to say that although IS has some characteristics of a state right now, it still has the resilience of an ideologically motivated terrorist organization that'll survive and even perhaps thrive in the face of setbacks. We must never again make the mistake we made in 08, which was to assume that we have destroyed a jihadist organization because we've pushed it out of former safe havens and inhibited its ability to hold territory. Bombing IS will not destroy it. Giving the Kurds sniper rifles or artillery will not destroy it. A new prime minister in Iraq will not destroy it. And he says that going into a war with IS actually builds them up. Because without war, IS is a fringe terrorist organization. With it, it is a state. And he says, advocating the defeat of IS over the short term without acknowledging what will be necessary to achieve that end is a recipe for mission creep. And that's a recipe for policy failure because the American people won't allow sustained investment in a policy they didn't commit to originally. This, he says, is the most important strategic lesson from Iraq. Don't bullshit the American people into a war with shifting objectives because they will not put up with that commitment long enough for those goals to be achieved. Well, I think there's some realistic, hard thinking there, and Brian Fishman's not a pacifist. He makes very clear. And I hope that his warnings will be taken into account. Meanwhile, the conflict has resumed in Gaza, 10,000 mourners turned out to bury three senior Hamas commanders who were killed earlier this morning, early Thursday, in pre-dawn airstrikes by Israel. And the bloodletting, carefully targeted by Israel, is often linked directly to revenge for previous acts. And Hamas is not doing itself any favors, and I don't know how to evaluate this, because one Hamas leader, Salah al-Aruri, who is based in Turkey, made a statement yesterday taking credit for the June 12th abduction and murder of three Israeli teenagers in the West Bank. And as you know, I have rejected the Israeli narrative and the thundering assertions by Benjamin Netanyahu that he knew Hamas did it. There's a great deal of evidence to the contrary. So I don't know if this is some sort of a psychological, you know, reverse psychology or exactly what. But in my view, there is no evidence that Hamas authorized that kidnapping and that the subsequent arrest of hundreds of Hamas members by Israeli forces during the 18-day manhunt for the missing teenagers who we now know Israel knew were already dead? Well, we'll see how it all sifts out, but that is conflicting information to what I have seen to be factual. Every day I like to pause and thank the people who support my podcast with their subscriptions. Recently, Ann Bryant Heyman came back into the fold with a new annual subscription. Thank you very much, Ann. I'm also looking at the page here with people who have annual subscriptions, and you don't get mentioned as often because the way I do it is I list the names from people who have just reported to have recently paid via PayPal. And if you only pay once a year, maybe you only get mentioned once a year. So let me single out Tom Burkhart, Anuel Rinaldi, and also Leanne Rayer. They're all annual subscribers, and I very much appreciate your support. I want to invite you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You know the drill by now, right? You follow the link under my picture on the homepage. Takes you to a page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. Best deal is that $50 annual. And today I'm actually going to go to the post office and mail out some bonus CDs. I apologize. It's been a while. And if you've been frustrated waiting for yours, well, you won't have to wait too much longer. The bonus CD right now is from John Dist. It's called Red Flag, with 10 great politically themed songs that I would love to send to you with your new annual subscription. We're told that the scene in Ferguson, Missouri is calm enough that Governor Nixon is ordering the National Guard to begin withdrawing. Personally, I don't know. I'm not there. I only see what they put on television. But last night, it appeared the protests were very small and quite peaceful for two reasons. The protesters maxed out and are burned out. They're tired. And some of the real hooligans, the troublemakers, have been arrested. The other factor is there was a tornado warning, and there were thunderstorms and rain in Ferguson last night, which I think may have caused some people just to stay home. Well, Attorney General Eric Holder dropped in for a soothing photo op. And the truth is that this is just window dressing. It's just political theater. Yes, the Justice Department will do an investigation, but I'd be surprised if it produces a different result than the state investigation or the local investigation. Nonetheless, Holder offered some poignant comments from his own experience. He recalled once being pulled over in New Jersey for driving while black, having his car searched. Quote, I remember how humiliating that was and how angry I was and the impact it had on me. And he told another story when he was a federal prosecutor walking to a movie theater in Georgetown in D.C. And he was harassed by some cops who said, "Where are you going?" And he said he was with a black buddy who wanted to mouth off. And then Prosecutor Holder restrained his friend. But Eric Holder's Justice Department is one that I criticize frequently, and I'm about to criticize them again in just a moment. But I was pleasantly surprised by a front-page story on my San Francisco Chronicle today, written by our buddy Bob Agelko, who is the legal affairs writer at the Chronicle. And he reports that the administration of Barack Obama, as compared with that of George W. Bush, has been prosecuting rogue police officers and police departments at a rate that is a 13% increase over what the Civil Rights Division did under Bush. Now, I was surprised by this. As you know, I don't have much confidence in the Attorney General, and I don't believe the Justice Department has been doing a very good job during this administration. But I want to report to you that this is a bright spot in an otherwise fairly bleak picture. And in addition to using hate crimes laws and other prosecutions against bad cops, they have also filed lawsuits against police departments in Seattle, New Orleans, Puerto Rico, and they're suing Maricopa County, Arizona's Sheriff Joe Arpaio for bias against Latinos. So, that's one thing I can say good about Eric Holder, and it has been a while. But now let's get to the critical comments about the Attorney General. Last Sunday's New York Times Maureen Dowd op-ed column focused on her Times reporting colleague James Risen and the way that Eric Holder's Justice Department is pursuing him despite the clear First Amendment violation that is entailed in trying to get him to reveal a source in court testimony. Dowd writes, "The Justice Department is trying to scuttle the reporter's privilege, ignoring the chilling effect that it is having on truth emerging in a jittery post-9/11 world prone to egregious government excesses. Holder wants to force Risen to testify and reveal the identity of his confidential source on a story he had in a book in 2006 concerning a bungled CIA operation during the Clinton administration. The tale made the CIA look silly, which may have been more of a sore point than a threat to national security. But Bush officials zeroed in on a disillusioned former CIA agent named Jeffrey Sterling as the source of that story. The subpoena forcing Risen's testimony expired just after Obama took office in 2009, and then Eric Holder renewed it. Holder said this past May that no reporter who's doing his job is going to go to jail, which appeared to be hinting that this is just a way to pressure Sterling, into pleading guilty. And James Risen himself, no shrinking violet, says it's hypocritical. A lot of people still think this is some kind of game or signal or spin. They don't want to believe that Obama wants to crack down on the press and whistleblowers, but he does. He's the greatest enemy to press freedom in a generation." Those are strong words. Those are accurate words. Meanwhile, Eric Holder's Justice Department has announced a new big cash settlement with a bank. Bank of America, no longer based here in California, it's run out of North Carolina, has agreed to pay almost $17 billion. About $9 billion in fines and $7 or $8 billion in consumer relief. And this stems from Hank Paulson's shotgun mergers back during the crash of 2008. When he essentially forced B of A, they didn't want to do this, to absorb Merrill Lynch, remember them? And Countrywide Financial, which Countrywide had written a lot of toxic mortgages. And I think there was a deal struck by Paulson. I have no proof of this. I'm just speculating here. But I think Paulson said, "Look, you take these over, We'll use TARP money to smooth everything out, cover your losses. We promise we won't prosecute you for any of the fraud committed by these companies, but you'll have to take some of the money we give you through TARP and pay it back to the government in fines later on. Meanwhile, invest that money and you can keep the keep the returns on it. Now, again, I want to underscore, I made all that up, but I don't think it's that far-fetched. Public Citizen reacting to this sweetheart deal today. The settlement thickens the list of private deals between government litigators and the largest financial institutions. The Department of Justice has largely shied away from aggressively prosecuting Wall Street banks and opted instead for fines and settlements. Bank of America's managers are at the center of mortgage fraud, but the Justice Department penalty will essentially fall on shareholders who certainly were not conspirators. The corrupt culture of Wall Street won't be reformed until perpetrators are held accountable. I agree with Public Citizen. Over at the War on Some Drugs, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, recognizing that the biggest cause of death due to drug in this country is from hydrocodone, Vicodin, OxyContin, and those related painkillers. And they have announced tough new restrictions. And if you have chronic pain and you use these drugs to manage that pain, and you know, you can use them without being addicted, not everybody is, I want you to know what the changes will entail. The rule places hydrocodone in a tougher, more restrictive category. Doctors will no longer be able to call in prescriptions by telephone. Patients will not be allowed to get refills on the same prescription. You'll have to go back to your doctor to get a new script. The drug will have to be kept in special vaults in pharmacies. The rule will take effect in 45 days. Now, currently, the abuse of painkillers claims more lives in America than heroin and cocaine combined. Some 20,000 people die every year in the United States from the abuse of these painkillers. And Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat, kind of, from West Virginia, where I believe they nicknamed hydrocodone and OxyContin hillbilly heroin, he applauded the change. He called the shift a tremendous step forward in fighting the prescription drug abuse epidemic. All right, Joe. We'll see how this works out. Sometimes these restrictions have a lot of unintended consequences. The U.S. Navy has announced that 34 sailors are being expelled from their ranks after the exposure of a cheating ring that operated undetected for at least 7 years at a nuclear power training site. This was at the Charleston, South Carolina Navy base. And this is pretty critical. These are the people who are being trained to run nuclear reactors on submarines and aircraft carriers. And if they were cheating on those exams, one can only fear what happens when they get into a critical problem with a reactor meltdown or something along those lines. And, well, they cheated on that part of the test. So Admiral John M. Richardson, the director of Naval Reactors, has been leading the charge to investigate and sweep out the cheaters. He said that he was originally loaded for bear at the outset of the investigation, but now he believes that the cheating was confined to a single training unit. And of course, you know, the Air Force has a scandal of people who cheated and violated the rules related to the nuclear weapons cache. This was in Minot, South Dakota, and one other Air Force base in that part of the United States. Well, I want to report to you that yesterday, at the end of our News and Comment podcast, I told you about the plight of Andrew Tomaresi, an ex-Marine who says he took a wrong freeway ramp near San Diego, San Ysidro, wound up in Mexico unexpectedly, didn't want to be there, wanted to come back, and they detained him because he had 3 loaded guns and 400 rounds of ammunition in the back of his truck. And I want to give a shout-out to one of our most devoted listeners, Cassandra Troy in Atlanta, Georgia, who picked up on that story and then found a couple of columns by an L.A. Times columnist, Robin Abkarian, about this case. And frankly, I was a little taken because I relied in my report yesterday solely on information that had been provided by Jill Tamaresi, the mother of the Marine who's been locked up in Mexico since April. And I want to credit this columnist, Robin Abkarian. I will link to her report in the show file for this podcast. But there are a couple of things I didn't know about. I didn't know this was a big story on Fox News and that they've been using it to hammer the Obama administration. And I knew that Andrew was a Marine veteran who we believe has PTSD in his retirement from military duty. He had moved to San Diego, but there's a lot to the story that was edited out of Mom's version. Now, a couple of things that Abkarian points out is that since he has been locked up, he made 2 escape attempts. One described as a ninja-style scaling of a wall topped with coiled barbed wire, and an incident in which he slashed his neck with a broken light bulb. Then they moved him into a prison in Tecate. His mother says he's in solitary confinement, and others say, well, he's got a private cell. Depends on the conditions there. That could be a wobbler. Then Abkarian helps us understand some of the other facts here. He didn't enter Mexico by mistake, according to another report by Inez Garcia Ramos in a video report from a Mexican outlet, apparently. It says that when he drove into Mexico on March 31st, border officers noticed a mattress, other large items in the truck. They waved him over. And contrary to the assertion of Tamaresi that he stopped to ask how to return to the United States, he appeared to be driving away from the border. So the case is a little more complicated and less black and white than Andrew's mom has told us. Abkarian goes on, at times, this young man has been his own worst enemy. After he was arrested, he claimed he had never been to Mexico before. In fact, he had crossed the border several times, including earlier on the day of his arrest. When he walked into Mexico, checked into Tijuana's Hotel Nelson, and then checked out and walked back to the United States. And this means that he left his 3 loaded guns and the 400 rounds sitting in his truck in a San Ysidro parking lot for hours. So the other point that his mom has made is that the Obama administration and the State Department have ignored her requests for attention on this matter. But Abkarian quotes a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, John Feely, saying that Tamaresi's case has gotten a tremendous amount of attention from the State Department. We've raised it repeatedly and at high levels with the Mexicans. Secretary Kerry did it in May. And he says he himself has raised the case with the Mexican ambassador in Washington. Our ambassador in Mexico has raised it. And it appears that just on the face of it, that Andrew Tamaresi is in deep doo-doo. And that the possession of these guns is a major crime that could see him facing a long jail term in a Mexican prison. And they've hired a shotgun-type lawyer, a hot-headed kind of dude, who is busy hoping to get the case thrown out or to win an acquittal based on a claim of innocence. Well, like so many stories, the one of Andrew Tamarisi is a lot more complicated than I originally thought about yesterday. Hey, thanks for joining me for News and Comment. Thanks to the listeners who contributed to this podcast today. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until